Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsive day for the 20th Nisan. We start with thanking the OU, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hochhausler, for all of their help with putting these shiurim together and getting them online to you. 20th Nisan is the sixth day of Pesach. Erev Shvi'i Shel Pesach, the day before the seventh day of Pesach, so it's the last day of Chol HaMoed, so it's a busy day, and actually, this is one of those times, every so often you hit a day where there are very few responsa, or almost none, and this was one of those examples. I think the only ones that I found dated to the 6th of, to the 20th of Nisan. Now, it could be the, I don't remember how I looked for the 6th day of Chol HaMoed Pesach, or just for the 20th of Nisan, but in any case, for the 20th of Nisan, all that I found was four responsa in different years from Shoel Vin Ishal. Shoel Vin Ishal is from Rabbi Chalfon Moshe HaKohen, who was a rabbi in Gerba in the late 19th century, early to mid 20th century. And he was remarkably prolific, and he always did his tshuvot very, very often. When I'm looking through a list of tshuvot to pick a tshuva for a day, there are multiple ones from Shoel Vin Ishal. I confess that I usually leave them out. I think it's because I've done a couple, one or two, from Shoel Vin Ishal on previous times. I don't usually choose them, I wanted to say, because he's from the island of Gerba, which I had never really realized was and still is a thriving Jewish community for many, many years, for many centuries, and has its own sort of insular attitude towards Torah. And that insular, I mean that it's not connected to much of the rest of the world. So while they quote many of the, you know, typical Sfarim that we would quote, they also have their own internal literature of Torah, so that I often find it sort of outside of the path of Torah, even of the broad sweep of the ones that I've been trying to expose us to in all of these discussions. That being the case, he gave us a chance here because he really is the only one that I found for the sixth day of Nisan, for the sixth day of Pesach, for the 20th of Nisan. And there were four of them. So we'll see them briefly together, and then we'll get a sense of at least some of what Chalfon Moshe HaKohen's Torah was like. This is from Shoel Vin Ishal. I took them in chronological order. This one is from the 20th Nisan of Tafresh Pei Vav of 1926. This is from Shoel Vin Ishal, the second volume, Or HaChaim Simon Tet, from the ninth response within the Or HaChaim section of that volume. And here the question was that within rice, remember that many Sephardi communities, rice is eaten on Pesach as long as you check it. So within some rice, they found some grains that looks like a little bit like dochan, but its husk apparently was similar to something that they knew of called, the word in Hebrew is zivuan. They say it's an Arabic word. So the question is, if you just take that out of the rice, can you leave the rest of the rice as if it's okay? Or since you don't know if this stuff, this grain, that they're not sure what it is, that's the problem. It looks a little bit dochan, I think that would be okay, but it looks, if it's like the zivuan, the Arabic zivan, that's more like a chametz grain, and you're worried about that. So that's the question. Can you rely on our identifications of these grains or not? So when he answers, so he says he remembers that poskim, he told Hamorim, right, the teachers customarily differentiate two kinds of zivan, this Arabic grainish kind of a thing. And he says, and I think it's from a tradition from the Chidah that they have, that the bigger one is called Merav, and the second one they call Michal, after the names of Shaul's daughters. And they have the poskim have a question about whether it creates chametz or not, whereas the bigger one, whereas the smaller one, everybody agrees, is permissible. Now, the Hilchos Beit Yehuda, he says, is a sefer, again, that I haven't really heard of, so I think it's one of his svarim that he has in his library in Gerba that isn't part of, you know, what I see quoted in other places, although that's obviously maybe my ignorance. So he quotes his Rebbe, his teacher, who differentiates between these kinds of things, even the same looking ones, if they're found within wheat or if they're found within rice, and that the ones that are within wheat are prohibited, like the wheat would be itself, and the ones in the rice are permissible as a kind of rice. But he doesn't differentiate there. So there, he doesn't talk about the different types there are. It almost sounds like, although this is what Rav Chalfon Moshe Cohen says, but it almost sounds like they're really basically the same, and the only difference is where they're found. So that would be one way to do it, right? If they're found, then you could say that there's different kinds of things. They look different, but we can't know which are which. So if they're found in one place, we cheat them one way, and another place, you go another place. Another way. Others, like the Maharshach, hold that there's no problem with chimush with these kinds of grains, and they're definitely not chametz, and therefore you don't have to worry about them at all. But yet another source has it that, and he says a mechaber, but I don't think he means the Shulchan Aruch, says that he has a tradition that those that are found in wheat, which are shaped differently, they're longer, like a zera pishtan, like a flax seed, but the ones that are found in the rice are shorter, they're just a grass, and they don't create any chametz at all, they can never become leavened. So now when the messenger had come with this particular question, to Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen, he had brought some of the rice and some of the other stuff that was in the rice, this is zivuan, and it looked short. It looks like not long, short, such that it would seem to be the kind that doesn't create any chametz at all, but it's also a little broad. And it's therefore not exactly like what he remembers Zivuan looking like, you know, from when he saw it. He doesn't see it all the time. When he saw it, that's not what he remembers it looked like. The ones that are found in chitim, the ones that are found in the wheat. So he thinks that for all the sources that we have, you don't have to worry about it. It would seem like you could even cook the rice with this stuff in it, you didn't have to worry about chametz at all. But he says he thinks it's better to get it out to begin with, and if there's some left over, right, then you don't have to worry about, and you can, but the reason to separate it out is that he's worried that there might be some wheat mixed in with it somewhere, and therefore he thinks it's better if you weed it out or separate it out, and also maybe, he says, you have to worry that it might, when it's being cooked, you might have it, all of a sudden lengthen from the process of cooking, and you'll come to realize that it actually looks more like wheat than you thought it did, and it's the actual other kind. And therefore, he thinks it's better, and then you'll have ruined the whole batch of rice, and therefore he thinks it's better to get it out to the extent that you can. And that's what he recommends on the 20th of Nisan of Tarfish Pevav of 1926. The next responsum, also from Chelik Bet of Shoel V'Nishal, from the Eridea section, Simon Kufnim Chet, responsum number 158, is a question about, there's a sircha. Sircha is when you look at the lungs of an animal, if you have lesions there, if you have problems there, you're worried that it might be a hole in the lung. And the reason why a hole in the lung is a problem is that holes in the lung would create a trephus, would make it a trephus, and then therefore the animal can't be shecht in the kosher way. So now let's say you find a sircha on the lobes of the lungs, of what are sort of the lungs, but it's farther down. It's acharei hatzel ha'acharona. It's below the bottom rib, or in the meat before the last rib, but in the last third of that. So the question, therefore, really is, I'm not going to get into all the technicalities of it. I'm going to continue on to the other two tshuvot after a brief discussion. But the question really is, how far down on an animal do we count it as the lung? Meaning this is continuous meat and continuous meat of the animal, and how far down do they go? You theoretically could have said it's all of it, but the tradition was that that's not true. The tradition was that the meat is below the lowest rib, is certainly not considered part of the trephus, part of the animal where a hole will make it a trepha, and even below the second to last rib, if it's in the last third of the portion there, then that would be also not a problem. So that's the question, or that's the question that we have. What do we possibly think about these issues when you have a sircha in those places? So he knows of a sefer. Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen knows of a sefer that would say that all of this meat up into the bottom, the very bottom of the very last rib, that it's prohibited if there are sirchot on it. But he says that according to the Beis Yosef, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that the Beis Yosef seems to say that in the name of the Itter, that the shear, the level of the last two tzla'ot, of the last two ribs, we already treat that as the chazeh of the animal. The chazeh of the animal is a part of the animal that would have been given to the Kohen after, it's one of the matnot kahuna, right? Matnot kahuna are parts of any animal. That's not a matter of it being a korban, a sacrifice. Any animal which a Jew owns in shechts, they're supposed to give matanot to the Kohen. Zroa l'chayayim in keva, right? That would be from any animal. From korbanot animals, you'd give the chazeh and the shok. So the question is, what's the definition of chazeh? But whatever the definition of the chazeh is, the chest, that's not going to be the definition of the the lungs that would create a problem of trefos. So if you hold that the bottom two ribs are going to be like a chazeh that's given to the Kohen, then you, so it gets the whole question there. There's a line there that he has, and that above the line would be considered part of the lungs, and below the line would be considered part of the chazeh, and it gets the whole discussion there that, you know, we don't have animals in front of us, we don't deal with these in our times, but we're coming to the questions of how exactly we define the trefot and where it's considered chazen, where it's considered lungs, and where it's a problem, and where it's not a problem. That's a tshuva from the 20th Nisan of Tavresh Pei Zayin of 1927. I will point out that one is not really related to the tshuva itself, but along the lines of his discussion, he points out that the Rambam has a particular opinion that he thinks would allow us to create a suffix, would allow us to create a doubt, but it's the Rambam against everybody else. But Chalfon Moshe HaKohen thinks that even the Rambam is a strong enough opinion that he can create a doubt in that way. He's a strong enough opinion that he would, even just his lone opinion, would be enough to create a sveik sveika. Okay, the third responsum is from the second volume, all of them are from the second volume of Shul HaVinishal. This is from the Evan Ezer section, Simon Yudchet. And this is, a man comes from a different city to the city of Djerba, and he marries a woman from Djerba. So so at the time of the wedding, they bring him a dowry, which is part of the way it works, right? The wife's family brings in a dowry, but in those times, and I think in some sort of community still, they would write a ketubah that wasn't just a formal document with formal numbers in it. They would write a ketubah that reflected actual numbers. So in this case, the actual number was, and they had him do a kinyan on it, right? To make sure that something has legal validity, you do an act of it. That's not an act of acquisition, really, because nobody's acquiring anything. They're acquiring just the right to enforce a commitment. So he makes commitment. That's, by the way, let's say we spoke about yesterday about selling chametz. It wasn't yesterday. We spoke on Thursday about selling chametz. So today when people sell chametz, I think they sell it to the rabbi. The reason they think that is because they make an act of acquisition, the rabbi makes an act of acquisition, they make an act of acquisition, so does the rabbi, or the rabbi makes an act of acquisition from them, they think, oh, I'm selling him my chametz, and then he's selling it to the non-Jew, but that's not what happens. That act of acquisition is just to authorize him, and it's formalizing his right of authority. So here, too, you take an act of acquisition to formalize his commitment to pay her the ketubah. Now, when they did that, they took an act of acquisition, and it authorized, or it formalized his commitment to pay her 3,000, whatever it was, 3,000 of the local currency, which was three times the dowry she had brought in. So it was the custom in Djerba to put that amount in the ketubah. The amount of the ketubah, now remember, let's remember, ketubah is only paid off in cases of divorce or the husband's death. And that was supposed to be all of his financial commitment to her. In the case of divorce, would he support her to whatever extent she needed support? That was what it was meant to be there for, maybe at least a year, whatever it was supposed to do. And in the case of death, it was what she got, because women, theoretically, at least in halacha, don't inherit from their husbands. So therefore, the ketubah took care of her in various ways. So the custom in Djerba was that whatever she brought in, that the ketubah would give her three times that. Now, it was supposed to be that the marriage is going to go on for a long time, right? They're going to not get divorced regularly. So that, I think, was time for the husband to have benefited from the dowry at least three times what he got. And that's why it all was seen as being proper and acceptable and appropriate. So he signs this and he does a kinyan for it. And then that ketubah got lost. So once they're coming to rewrite it, they again come back and they do a kinyan with him. And this time he pays more attention. And they're planning on writing a ketubah. It's called a ketubah de irkasa. A ketubah you write when it's lost, when the original ketubah was lost. The reason you write a ketubah de irkasa is so that you can know that the first one was lost and not pay off two ketubot. So that's what you call a ketubah de irkasa. And they write a ketubah de irkasa. And then when they tell him the numbers, he says, oh, that's not our custom. Our custom is that we don't give triple the ketubah. Our custom is that we give it double the ketubah. That's where he came from. And therefore, he says he doesn't want to pay triple, and he doesn't want to commit to triple. Now, and her, the wife and her relatives are saying that he already has accepted the three times, and he is marrying her in Djerba. So he's marrying her in Djerba. He apparently is accepting the customs of Djerba. I'm not sure I made clear before, but I think I should have made it clear. Djerba is an island off the coast of Morocco, and it has this long-standing Jewish community that's been there for centuries and that is relatively isolated and therefore sort of keeps to itself and develops on its own, but has a thriving Jewish life. So if you wanted to do different than what they do in Djerba, he should have made it a specific condition and been explicit about it. Now, he says he didn't know the custom of Djerba. He assumed that everybody does what they do back in his own town. And also, when he made that kinyan, it was at the wedding, and he didn't know what was going on. He didn't know how much he was bringing in. So when they told him a number, he figured that the dowry was going to be half that number. Now that's a little bit of a hard claim, because then when he saw he didn't have that much money, he should have gone back and figured it out. But I think the point is that he claims he didn't really know what was going on. Maybe he was all involved in the wedding, and therefore they don't want to know what to do. So that's what they're turning to. They want to know what to do with this couple and how to rewrite the ketubah, because they can't live together until they write the ketubah, and they want to figure it out. So his answer, Rav Chafon Moshe Cohen's answer, is that the claims of the two sides, both of them seem fully accurate to him. In other words, and this is part of where halacha becomes really important in life, right? It's both true, he thinks, that the custom in Djerba is X way, and that the man didn't know that was the custom in Djerba. Custom was X way, and he didn't know he was the custom. So she thought she was getting a ketubah, and she did get a ketubah that had in it written in it three times the value of the dowry. He assumed he was only being committing to twice the value of the dowry, and now he didn't know what to do. But that's an important piece, because nobody's lying. There's nobody who's in the wrong here. It's a question of they have a disagreement about what the facts should have been, even though they thought they had agreed on the facts to begin with. That, by the way, is one of the reasons that people have lawyers. Not that you should have a lawyer when you get a ketubah, but one of the arguments for lawyers is that there's the kinds of people who predict these kinds of things or anticipate these kinds of things and know how to make sure that each side is clarified and how to make sure that each side understands what it's getting into and is fully comfortable with what it's getting into. It doesn't always work that way, and that's why lawyers continue to have a lot of work. But that's what's going on here. Nobody's a bad guy. Nobody's trying to cheat anybody else. And now they have a disagreement. A disagreement they could have had way back at the original wedding, but now they have a disagreement. The question is, what do you do about it? So Rav Chafon Moshe HaKohen's answer is an interesting one. He says, if the man had made a condition with the woman before they got married, and they were going to live back where he was from. So let's say he's from Paris or London or whatever, and he comes to Djerba on a business trip, meets a young woman, decides to get married. She decides she likes him. She wants to get married. And they're going to get married. If he said, we're going to have the wedding here, and we'll have the celebration here, we'll have the Shavuot Brachos here, but then we're moving back to Paris. And then, says Rav Chafon Moshe HaKohen, not only is it he said that they were going to do it right away, right after the Seven Mishnah, even if he said, I can stay here for a year or two because I have business here, but we're eventually moving back. If that's good enough, Rav Chafon Moshe HaKohen thinks, for that to be true, that the essential city of their marriage is his original city. And if that's his original city, that's where we assume the conditions of the ketubah were that he meant to fulfill. But if he agreed that they were going to live in Djerba or in one of its environs, maybe meaning that she says, well, you know, I love you maybe, but I'm not moving away from home, so it's fine, we'll live here. So then you write the ketubah like in Djerba. Now, let's say they didn't make a condition. By the way, I just want to point out that it's an interesting thing. He says the next option is they didn't make a condition, right, about whether they're going to stay, whether they live here in its environs or in his city. I'm reminded of, there's a scene in Love Actually. It's a movie, which some people know, some people don't, and it allows me an opportunity to pretend like all the time I waste spending watching movies, it really fuels my Torah understanding, because I can quote things like this every once in a while. So there's a scene of a man who marries a woman who barely knows. He flies to, I think she's supposed to be from the Basque region of Portugal. It's a flaw in the movie's plot, that it's not clear where she's from. But in any case, that's what's supposed to be true. And he moves there. He goes there to propose to her, and while he's proposing, he says, you can come back and live with me in England, or I can live here. So what do you do then? There's no condition. And now, let's say they get married, and let's say they were Jewish, and you come back and you want to know how much the ketubah should have been. You don't have any good evidence for what should have been, because neither one of them, because they weren't clear. So that's similar to what he says now. Let's say that he didn't make a condition with her about where to live, and they got married here, and now we want to know what we have to do. So he says, the Shulchan Aruch sounds like that she has to go with him to his city. That's the general assumption of marriages. So unless he made an explicit condition that he was going to stay with her, and he was going to stay with her long-term in Djerba, she has to assume they were going to move back to where he's from, because that's the way marriages tend to go, and therefore the ketubah would be assumed to be in the version that he assumes is true, which is double the dowry rather than triple the dowry. Now, that's the kind of a question where, even if he's right completely, that that's the assumption at some point in halacha, the question becomes, is that in general the point of halacha, the assumption of halacha, or the assumption of halacha in most societies, but let's say a society develops where the general assumption is that husbands stay with where the woman wants to stay, that would be a whole different kind of thing. But that's where he goes so far. He also adds one more piece to this tshuva. Let's say he lived in that city more than a year before he met her and he got engaged to her and whatever. So there is a general halachic principle. There is a general halachic principle that when somebody's living in a city for a year, even if they think to themselves that they're going to go back to another city, to another place, he's already considered a full resident of this place. That's true for halachot, like for minhag issues and for other things like that, and for paying taxes issues. So in all those situations, he's considered a full resident. So it says for Moshe Pachal, for Moshe Cohen, if he's considered a full resident, then you would also assume, even if he had made a condition where they were going to move back eventually to his place, he would also have had to make a condition that the ketubah had to be written according to the original customs of the place that he's from and not from here, because otherwise you just assume that he follows the customs of the place that he's in. That's also a tshuva from the 20th of Nisan of Tafresh Pei Zayin of 1927. So far we have tshuva from 1926, two tshuvot from the 20th of Nisan of 1927. This is apparently how Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen. So that's three tshuvot for the 20th of Nisan, for the 6th of Pesach. The fourth one, which we'll do, is from, again, the second volume, Yodea Simon Ayin Chet, but this is from several years later, from Tofri Tzadi Aleph, from 1931. And now it's a question of, this is a question about a knife that's used for shkita. Let's remember that a shkita knife needs to be extremely smooth. Otherwise, we're worried that if it catches, that it's going to rip out the flesh from the makam ashkita, from the place where you shecht an animal, where you slaughter an animal, rather than slice through it. It has to be absolutely a slice, not anything else. And therefore, any pegima, any break in the knife, any impediment to its smooth slicing could be a problem. So now you have three shochtim, they check a knife, and then after the shkita, they check the knife, there's three of them, and they think it feels like there might be a pegima. It feels like there might be some kind of a, it's not a blemish, it's a bump or a crack. Something that would cause a break in the smooth slicing would be an issue. So they wanted to see if maybe it was just a piece of dirt or something, so they washed the knife and they wiped it down with a rag, and then they check it again. Now, one of them was still unsure, but the two other ones say it's certainly pogom. It certainly has something sticking in the way that makes a problem. So now they show it to a fourth shochet, and he says he doesn't feel anything wrong with it. So they wash it again, and they dry it again, and they wipe it again, and they check it again, and now one of them says it's less than it was, but it still feels like there's still a break there. And the other three say, nope, now there's nothing. So now the question is, what is its status in terms of the shkita that it just did? I mean, you shechted the animal, and you checked it, and then you got all these problems and all these issues. So Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen says, he thinks that it would seem like you have to say it's usur, because the washing of it in the water was presumably that there was blood congealed on it, right? You're worried about the blood, and you want to take out the blood, because that was certainly going to feel like a peguma, but that's not a problem, because that blood probably came from the animal and then dried onto it. So therefore, when they washed it, and then they wiped it with the rag, or whatever they were going to clean it with, and then they check it, so, and now there used to be a pegam, and now they're not sure there's a pegam, there used to be a break in it, and now they're not sure. That's presumably because they melted it off a little bit. The blood that was there was done off, and therefore you would assume that was there. But then whatever else might have been there even before you did the shkita, and now you're washing it away, you're wiping it away, you're taking it off, and that's a big problem. Because the truth is, we know of cases that if you just run a knife on the part of your hand that you put, not even on the nail of your thumb, which is where people generally checked on the thumb and right near the nail, you just do it on the hand where you wrap your tefillin, he says, And just doing that can remove a pegima from a knife, can remove a blemish from a knife, something that's sticking onto a knife that you would have thought would be a problem for shechita, can remove it. And therefore, that would seem to be what you did. You took off stuff that was actually the pegima, that was a problem for the knife, and that would have rendered the shechita invalid, and now you took it off, so it would seem like we have you had something there, and then you washed it off, you wiped it away. And then he says, it's especially true because you have to assume that shochtim, that slaughterers, do their best to check if there's a begima or not, because they don't want to get into trouble. So if they say there's a begima, there's a problem with the knife, you got to assume that's right, especially when they first say, I'm not sure, and they later say that it's for sure true, then you have to think to yourself that they're telling the truth, because they don't want to get into problems with knives. But then he suggests a theory, he says, that other people have to agree too. As we've seen this before, this is becoming sort of a recurring theme, that other people have to agree to this before he's willing to go for it. But if other rabbinim agree, he can say, well, maybe the whole thing that they found before was all a question of blood, that it congealed. It congealed quickly and you didn't realize it, and therefore that's what they were feeling, and therefore when you washed and you took off the rag, you would not have a problem because that was all the blood. The blood comes later, and therefore, and that's why also you can have a situation where once you wipe it down, wash it, wipe it down, and it reduces, that's why you could say what I first was for sure a pegima, now it's only possibly a pegima, because that's what you're doing, and you're softening up the blood as you wash it, and therefore you can do it. And he also says you can ignore the one shochet who said, no, there's still a pegima, because when one guy says something and three people disagree with him, we're allowed halakhically to ignore the one who says that there's a pegima, because his opinion is beaten out by the majority. He also says, by the way, that all this is better if when you wipe off the water, you wipe it off softly enough that you can't remove any real pegima, right? If you have real congealed, bad, problematic stuff, that the wiping away, the pulling it off would not be sufficient for us to pull it off, then you can be more sure that you're okay, that it was the only thing you were getting off was congealed blood, which isn't a problem. That's his tshuva from the 20th of Nisan for Tafrei Tzadi Aleph for 1931. And these are four brief tshuvot by Rav Chalfa Moshe HaKohen from the 20th of Nisan, from the 6th day of Pesach, leading into the 7th day of Chag, from Erev Yom Tov, the 7th day of Pesach. These are some tshuvot that we saw from Chalfa Moshe HaKohen, with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, to David Hochhauser. A responsive day for the 6th day of Pesach. Have a great day.